And I got a call today from one of the lawyers I work with out of California named John Brinca, quite a famous entertainment lawyer. He asked me to help with Michael Jackson's concert in the UK, and we had to figure out how he was going to be taxed on his performance income. In those days, you could actually negotiate deals with the Inland Revenue, which made sense. It's a lot tougher today for reasons I'm happy to get into if you want.
You're listening to Carrie Lutz's Financial Survival Network, where you get valuable information you just can't find anywhere else. To thrive in today's trying times, you need the Financial Survival Network, now more than ever. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and get your free newsletter and gift. Financial Survival Network, now more than ever.
And welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm your host, Carrie Lutz. Got a special guest for you now. Well, I'm a recovering attorney. He's a semi-recovered attorney. His name is Charles Lubar. Charles, you started out your illustrious career basically working for the IRS, for the chief counsel's office. And from there, your story is rather remarkable. We'll be talking about it, but your book is An Improbable Journey, Music, Money, and the Law. And hey, from there, you were representing celebrities like Michael Jackson, Jim Henson. You had a little subspecialty there of porn star tax issues. I mean, you knew everybody, did everything. One of the most amazing things is you were actually representing people who knew or lived in the house that Wolfgang Mozart lived in.
Yeah, I like the fact that that means something to you, because, you know, if you asked most people interested in music in today's world, who was Johann Nepomuk Hummel, they would say, we never heard of him. Late 18th century, early 19th century, he was one of the greats. He was the only student that Mozart ever had in his house. He played at 10 years old all over Europe. He became a composer and a very famous character. And I mean, I ended up looking after the fourth and fifth generations after Johann Nepomuk Hummel.
Amazing. And
I can give you as much on this as you'd like to hear, or you can read it, but it's a story.
Well, let's talk. So you were working for the IRS in Washington, and you had the good sense to follow another path. Because if you were there today, you know, you'd be up on Capitol Hill, and they'd be asking you all sorts of nasty questions. So I think you got out of D.C. at exactly the right time.
Well, I had a fascinating experience in the chief counsel's office. We used to field questions from all over the United States. And the division I was in, the interpretative division of chief counsel, was kind of a scholarly place. Your job was to come up with the right answer, not necessarily be strongly pro-government. They wanted the correct answers, and they decided what they do with the correct answers. And I did some great stuff. I mean, I was involved in taxation of the taxation of Lloyd's of London when they recharacterized them from being an excise tax basis to an income tax basis. And I mean, I learned a lot there, and I had a lot of friends there. They just thought I was totally crazy when I decided to leave it.
Well, I guess you got an offer you couldn't refuse. But
like to go to Africa, you mean?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. What happened? How did you? Leaving.
Oh, okay. I was there. You normally have a 4-year commitment. I was there 2.5, almost 3 years. I got fascinated by post-independence Kenya because I was involved in a diplomatic program in Washington, D.C., which is my hometown. My first wife was the co-chairman of the Young Adults Program. This was a very good diplomatic program founded by the wife of John Foster Dulles to acquaint the diplomatic community with Washington, D.C. So my first wife was chairman of the chairman I knew from because I knew the family. She was running the young adults program, and she was married to a Kikuyu from the sub-clan of Jomo Kenyatta, the first president of Kenya. And he was a fascinating guy. His village had raised $4,000 in the auction of pigs and cattle and bananas and stuff, and sent them to a university of Gonzaga in Washington State.
Amazing.
I met him 7 years later. He was getting a PhD in political science at George Washington in Washington. And I really liked him, and we got on really well. And I got fascinated with what Kenya was going through. Not that I knew that much about African history or post-colonial British history, but I was excited about it. I was a little bored with the IRS. And he said, I want to go into business. I don't want to go into the normal route back in my home country. So we talked about different alternative businesses, and I ended up raising a little bit of money for him and decided that with a wife and a 12-week-old daughter, why not take a risk and see where it led? And so I moved to Nairobi, Kenya in 1969 with a wife and a 12-week-old baby in partnership with this Kenyan with a little bit of investment money. And it wasn't total crapshoot. I had worked out what I could afford to do and what experiences I could have, was willing to address. I spent a couple of years there. We built houses. We got into small-scale manufacturing. Built houses for middle-class people, because Nairobi was pretty much, it's up pretty high. It's about 9,000 feet, and it's close to the equator, but it's a garden. And it really was a garden even then. So I ran this business with him, and then after the houses were sold, we got into small-scale manufacturing through a monopoly program that the Kenya government developed to provide a role for the African entrepreneur as he was taking over from the Indian. Mm-hmm. We had the exclusive monopoly on the manufacturing of shoe eyelets. You know what a shoe eyelet is?
I think the shoelace goes through.
Laces, that's right. Nobody could import. Nobody else could compete with us. Yeah. And the only problem was my partner ran for parliament.
Mm-hmm.
Even worse than that, he won. And he lasted about 2 months, and he was on a state visit to India, got ill, came back to Nairobi City Hospital, and he died 2 days later.
Wow.
In mysterious circumstances, but I can't address that in any way, but it was enough to say that we said to the government, okay, government, take back your Kenya, your shoe eyelet factory, and just give us the money we put up. And they said, well, you got to understand, it's the Nairobi Industrial States, where the property was located and the manufacturing was located, was only for Africans, so we have to distribute the assets to your partner's estate. Unfortunately, it's hopelessly bankrupt, so we'll distribute the assets to the miscellaneous African creditors. That's my story. That's my story in Kenya.
Okay, which shows... why, when you were a foreigner, every place in the world, except perhaps the United States, and even there, not always the case, that you're better off sticking close to home, right?
Well, sticking close to home would have been a much easier life, much less exciting life.
For sure.
You know, been remunerative or not, who knows? But anyway, I didn't do that, and when I decided to leave Kenya, even then I didn't really want to go back to the United States and go through the orthodoxy of joining a major firm and working my way up and
right.
We're doing something else.
How'd you wind up in the entertainment field, though, with all these celebs? How did you stumble upon Michael Jackson?
Well, okay, bit by bit. First, I wandered around Europe. I had about 4 different contacts from Rome, Zurich, Paris, and London. And I happened to have an opportunity in London, which I really couldn't turn down. There were 2 entrepreneurial American lawyers, one a famous entertainment lawyer named Irwin Margulies, the former executive vice president of Warner Brothers. He partnered with a man named Barry Sterling, who was a very fine corporate transactional lawyer, and they were setting up a little boutique firm in London as an American lawyers living in London, which it could do under the Law Society rules at the time. They needed a tax lawyer, and as I say to many of my friends, they hired me off the streets. I joined them in 1971. As a result of joining them, I got acquainted with the whole issue of the foreign community living and working in the UK, many of whom were in the entertainment industry. It was not a great time for the industry in the early 70s, but it was bustling and it had lots of people, everything from Canadian to French producers, to people who had escaped the McCarthy era in London, in the United States. It was a fascinating group of people, and I got to know a lot of them. More importantly, I got to understand, I was already reasonably trained as a tax lawyer. I knew the American side, but I didn't really understand the UK side. But I had so much exposure to it and had so many meetings with so many talented legal scholars or legal accountants or accountants in the tax world that I learned a lot of the UK side by osmosis. And I had that instinct to be able to work both systems, both as a protection sometimes and sometimes offensively. So I represent a lot of people already who are the American community living in London and a reasonable number of entertainers. If you call Marilyn Chambers and Linda Lovelace entertainers, living and working a bit in London. So that's how I did it. And about 3 years after I was with this little boutique firm, the corporate lawyer went back to California, ended up owning a vineyard, became a very successful businessman, leaving the entertainment lawyer on his own with a few associates, but it was not a world that I wanted to stay in. Mm-hmm. Well, I felt I would take the risk and open up my own practice. I had developed some pretty good relationships with different people, and I had two, if you read from the book, I mean, two opportunities. One was to represent the European side of a big U.S. shopping center developer, and the other was doing work for the fourth and fifth generations of a very famous German composer and pianist who most of the audience you have probably never heard of, named Johann Nepomuk Hummel. Hummel had been a student of Mozart, lived in Mozart's house, became very famous as a composer and a pianist. And four generations down the line, I got involved in some fascinating stuff, which I'm happy to talk about if you want me to go that route. If you'd rather have me talk about Michael Jackson, I can do that too.
Let's talk about Michael Jackson. How'd you wind up with him?
Okay. I was doing work for a lot of foreign entertainers, many American, mm-hmm. would come over to perform. And I would speak, and by that time I'd been speaking and writing and editing various text journals and so forth. And so I got to know people in the industry, the entertainment, and was called upon to act for many of the artists who did performances, mm-hmm. not always in London. I mean, I did some work for Santana all over Europe and a bit for Harrison Ford, but basically it was London-based kind of practice. And I got a call today from one of the lawyers I work with out of California named John Brinka, quite a famous entertainment lawyer. We asked me to help with Michael Jackson's concert in the UK, and we had to figure out how he was going to be taxed on his performance income. In those days, you could actually negotiate deals with the Inland Revenue, which made sense. It's a lot tougher today for reasons I'm happy to get into if you want. But anyway, I guess 2 or 3 years later, John Branca called me and said, listen, we've got something really serious for Michael. He looks like he wants to buy the ATV Music Catalog Group, which is about 5 or 6 catalogs, including the Beatles catalog.
Right. I remember. Yeah.
He bought some stuff, but he really was excited about this one. Mm-hmm. He, of course, wanted to buy his copyrights back. Obviously, he had the writer's share of the publishing income, but he didn't have the writer, but he didn't have the publishing interests.
Right.
Owned by this ATV Music Group, which had at one time been owned by or controlled by Sir Lou Grade. But it just at this point in the juncture, mid-80s, it was owned by Robert Holmes of Court, an Australian buccaneer entrepreneur. And so John Branca asked me to help figure out how the hell we could buy all those catalogs and make sense out of it, Michael being a U.S. citizen, resident in the U.S., the catalogs being fully depreciated shell companies owning nothing but very valuable copyrights.
Right.
Figure out how to do that to make it sensible for Robert Holmes of Court, who really needed to get his money back to Australia because he had his own financial issues back there. And to make it sensible for Michael took a lot of work. And it didn't pop out of my head right away. I mean, I spent a lot of time on it and spent a lot of time with some very talented people putting together the program and figured out a way for basically Michael to buy the entire catalog, group of catalogs, including the Beatles catalog, with pre-tax money, whereas Paul McCartney would have had to buy it with post-tax money. And I'm happy to get into you don't need to know that. If you want to read about the technical side, I think the International Financial Law Review sometime in 1986 when it described the transaction. But bottom line was we took six companies outside the UK, ran them in the Bahamas for 6 months, liquidated the copyrights up to Michael's personal hands. Result was he got a step up in basis to the full fair market value of the copyrights in the catalog, which he could depreciate against the income going forward. And I mean, that was something that was not available to Paul McCartney, period. And it made Michael's made it much easier for him to spend more money to buy the catalogs. But in terms of competition, you could imagine how attractive it would have been for him.
For sure. Yes.
And that's what I did for him. And then after a couple of years later, he put his catalogs into a joint venture with Sony, which is where it is today. Mm-hmm. And I did some of the foreign side of trying to create partnership structures, which worked a lot better than corporate structures for Americans who are doing business outside the United States.
All right. So you kind of got these celebrities right in their weakest moments when they're talking about taxes, right? Remember John Lennon's song, Tax Man?
Yeah. That's right. Well, that's what they were facing, and that's why they sold their copyrights. They sold rights to this ATV Music Group because that way they could at least get a capital gain at a time. The ordinary income rates in the UK were catastrophic. I mean, they were really high.
I guess they didn't know about intellectual property trusts back then?
Well, they knew something of it, but the U.S. law was a little more sophisticated. And, you know, and the rates were very high in the UK for individuals.
Sure. All right. So who was the most interesting client you ever had?
Well, the truth is, I mean, you'd like to say the Muppets or Albert Finney or, you know, other people in the entertainment world, and they were very interesting stories. But the most interesting client I really had was this Johann Nepomuk-Hummel, the student of Mozart who lived in Mozart's house, and I represented the fourth and fifth generations. And I'll give you the first story, and you can tell me whether you want to go beyond that. But it was basically the history of the 20th century on the back of paintings of the second generation, but we'll get to that in a minute. My first job when I came on the scene was to deal with a woman who was a sister of my direct client, about the fourth generation down. She had lived in Weimar and moved to Italy, to Florence. With her came the entire manuscript collection of Johann Nepomuk Hummel, which consisted of letters between Hummel and all of his friends in the late 18th century, early 19th century, Beethoven, Liszt, Mendelssohn, Goethe, Schiller. Mm-hmm. Included also manuscripts, original manuscripts of Hummel with notations from his teacher Mozart.
Really?
She had taken that entire collection and given it to the Goethe Museum in Dusseldorf with a right to revoke the gift before she died. And when I met her through the brother, she was non-compos mentis with a brain tumor. Mm. And her brother, who had been thrown out of a prominent German family in the 20s because they thought he was stupid, it's just he wasn't fitted with glasses. But he got to the U.S. and they, you know, that's what a German family did when they were embarrassed about someone in their family. They sent him to America. This guy was retired, living in a trailer park in California. Met him through his son, who became a major instruction guy. But the old man was the one who really controlled things. And he asked me to help him. And the first job was to break the gift. So I had a friend, a tax lawyer in Dusseldorf, a good friend of mine, and we went to town with the city of Dusseldorf, took about a year, and we actually did break the gift. We broke the gift, and the part of the deal in breaking the gift, we turned around and sold the entire manuscript collection to the Goethe Museum in Dusseldorf, who put it, well, to the city of Dusseldorf, who put it back into the Goethe Museum. I had enough money from the sale of that catalog to move my actual client from his trailer park in San Diego into the hills of San Diego with a little house and a swimming pool, and made his life comfortable for the rest of his life. And it was a really great feeling. And I think the city of Dusseldorf could afford the modest amount of sum.
The least they could do.
Required.
The least they could do. Come on.
That was the first thing I did for them.
All right. So let me ask you a question here.
Yeah.
Your experience, everything. You see the tax system now. What is the biggest problem with the United States system of taxation, in your opinion?
Very simple. The U.S. taxes on the basis of citizenship. Almost no other country in the world have taxes on the basis of citizenship.
They do residency, right?
Exactly. Exactly. They do it on the basis of where your center of vital interest is, where you're really resident. Mm. And you could be a Brit living in Kenya. You could be a Frenchman living in South Africa, and the jurisdiction where you live took the primary tax burden. Whereas with the Americans tax you on the basis of citizenship, no matter where you live. And a lot of my practice has developed over the years, everything from expatriating Americans who were fed up with America for one reason or another. Sometimes it was political, sometimes it was taxation. But I've expatriated my little team. When I was on my own, and then later with Morgan Lewis, we expatriated probably more Americans than anybody in London. In fact, I was called by some of my more conservative friends in America an economic Benedict Arnold. Mm. You know, I was a traitor to America by encouraging Americans to give up American citizenship.
You're doing God's work. You're doing God's work. Well, hey, really, really appreciate your coming on the show here and sharing your experiences with us here. It's really been a lot of fun, Charles. Hey, the book, again, Charles has written a book, and it's a doozy, and you want to take a look? An Improbable Journey, Music, Money, and the Law. And it's available on Amazon and wherever fine books used to be sold. And if you got a question for Charles or myself, shoot me an email, kl@carrylutz.com. Make sure you go over to the site, financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Link to Charles's site book will be there. And while you're there, sign up for your free newsletter. Charles, I could talk to you all day, but we don't have the time. Really appreciate you coming on. We'll talk to you again. Get some more stories out of you. How's that sound?
That sounds wonderful to me. I enjoyed talking to you. you're an entrepreneurial lawyer, as I guess I was or is. So I enjoyed it very much.
Likewise. Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to Cary Lutz's Financial Survival Network, your solution to today's trying times. For the latest, go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Financial Survival Network, now more than ever.